What I'm going to talk about to start this evening talk is not a parallel universe. Not a parallel universe. There isn't a parallel universe. There's just this universe. The idea of a parallel universe, as I'm going to describe it, is based on distorted perception. So for probably the last, I'm going to guess, 6, 7, maybe 8 weeks here, the themes have been primarily truth, reality, freedom, awakened nature, what we really are. These are all the same. What we really are is reality, truth, freedom, original, ordinary, primal nature. And again, these are just words. Between the period of time of the second trimester, when this was in the womb, and 2 years of life, 2 years old, we all went through that. That period in there, the left hemisphere of the cerebral cortex, where primarily thoughts, conceptions, imaginations, projections are occurring, unmyelinated, inactive. What's happening in that critical period of development, you could say in terms of hemispheric activity, is pure right brain. That's why the unborn in the last, say, 3 months of the oven bake and the baby up to 2 years of age is living essentially in its original nature. Unified field consciousness, no subject-object dichotomy, no self, no other. Now granted, there were and are things that happen that if they're not attended to by the caregiver, primarily, let's say, mother, they could lead to distress of a greater degree. Food is needed, comfort is needed, warmth is needed. And this thing is registering directly those sensations. You could say intuitively, intelligently responding to that. Provided we got a good enough base of bonding, you could say, of development in that area, we then take a shift and transition around the age of 2, give or take a bit, into a place where thought arises for the first time. I am, thought arises for the first time. A sense of self and other arises for the first time. The mother, or caregiver, it's often the mother, is recognized as other than me. This is the birth of the story of me. This is the birth of the story of the apparent self. Last 2 weeks, we talked about the dissolution of the apparent sense of self to rather in-depth, thorough kind of investigations that went on quite a bit, as I recall. If my memory serves me well. Most of you, some of you were here, some of you, many of you weren't actually. And the reason why it was called the dissolution of the apparent sense of self is it is an apparent sense of self sitting here. What is actually sitting here is not what your brain says. This is. What is sitting here, what is happening here, is the universe. Reality, full on. Truth, freedom, original, true, authentic, liberated nature. That's what's actually happening here. So what's the difference between what I am saying and what we might think this is? Based on what we think this is based on perception. It's based on what in Buddhism is called view. And the, you could say, progressive or dual teachings of truth, the Buddha being one truth teacher, says there's right view, correct view, accurate view, and there's incorrect view. The whole culmination of the practice, the yoga, the meditation, is to dissolve the apparent distorted or wrong views in the mind. It isn't wrong in the sense of bad that all of us develop the subject-object perspective. But when that subject-object perspective is believed to be all there is not seen to be just a view, is catered to, cherished, maintained, reinforced. This is exactly what the Buddha pointed at when he said, birth in the body, as the body-mind process, that view, I am the body-mind process, perpetuates, begins and perpetuates the unfolding of what's called samsara. And this samsara would be described as perpetual wandering. Looking for home in sometimes all the wrong places. If only I had, if only I didn't have, if only this would change, if this would go away, if this wasn't here, if this was here, if only you were just a little bit different or a lot different, if only I had, and that's the samsaric wandering mind. It's not right or wrong fundamentally in a bad or good sense. It's what happens. So I prefer to use the word instead of right view or wrong view. Correct. Accurate. True. Distorted. I think those words are a little bit more operative here because, again, every single word, if you're familiar with the word, you have conditioning around that word. If you've heard the word before, you have conditioning in your brain around that word. I was talking to a very wise man, a very intelligent, holistic medical doctor over the weekend. And he said, we all would have been better off if we never thought a thing. And I said, oh yeah, you mean like dogs? He said, yeah, that's it. He goes, just be like a dog, Paul, and things will be better for you. And then I joked in the way I typically would look for the joke, and I say, do you ever notice that dogs never have a mood disorder? He said, that's good, I'm going to write that down. See, I was in a consultation with him as his patient, and when that shift happens, I want to say, and now my fee is being reduced. Every one of those one-liners reduces my fee by $10 more. So you better fill the space with something else, because if you let me speak, I'm going to say something that changes the arrangement here, and you will owe me if you say, oh, that's good, I'm going to write that one down. These things that really, really matter do not ever have a price tag. They're incomparable. Correct, accurate, true view is priceless. So our conditioned mind, our story mind, our narrative mind, nothing wrong with it, nothing actually right about it, it's just what it is, believes things are the way it thinks they are. And then we sit. We sit for just 45 minutes here. Just, I say. Somebody said to me, if I come on one of those retreats, I only have one question. How long are the sittings? And I said, for you, we can extend them. 45 minutes. 45 minutes is a long time. Thinking about 45 minutes. It's, I could die during that 45. What if he extends it to 47? Like all of a sudden 2 minutes is just hugely problematic. Whereas before, like 45 minutes, and we thought about it, 47 minutes doing, you know, what one loves to do, so to speak, and time flies. Yeah, time flies when you're having fun. As my mom was passing her last 2 days of life, she looked up onto the wall, and all of a sudden she proclaimed, I should say, that would be a better word, she proclaimed, time has wings. Her brow went up like this, like she was in wonder. Time has wings. Time flies. What's time flying through? Yes, time. Measured time is part of reality. Because if we want to talk about reality, we can talk about relativity. But if we want to talk about reality, we can also talk about that which is not relative. That which is permanent. Very few words for this. But the ones that we do have are very poignant. Eternity, eternal, absolute, unconditioned, non-dual, oneness, wholeness. Where do these words point? I mean, if you're making a bundt cake, you know the bundt cake, the round ones? You're making a bundt cake, the cake is whole when it's round. Somebody came and cut a piece out. It's not whole. It's missing. It's slice. Whole. One. Eternal. Timeless. How about boundless? Where do these words point? Some other kind of synonym in our common narrative? We could do that. Maybe find a few more. The point of those kinds of words is to stop looking for more words. And open to what the word directly points to. Notice this. In a sentence, the word the points to the car was black, right? Clear. Take the word the by itself. What does that point to? Where's the object for the word the? Not there, is it? If the does all alone. Since we now have this myelinated, overly active in some cases, left hemisphere of our cerebral cortex that's capable of thinking about almost everything, and nothing, by the way, because if I said, for the next 5 minutes I'll shut up and I'd like you all to think about nothing. And then we come up with nothings like, and this is a stupid exercise. You should be meditating instead of listening to this idiot. It's a good thought. How about everything? Think about everything. Only for a few minutes, think about everything, and then we'll stop the exercise. Probably come up with more stuff. Everything is, everything's like. The point of the words, if we really understand what words are for, in their ultimate sense, ultimate value, is the point where there's no more words. If the Zen master is fiercely looking at you and says, show me your true face before you were born, what are you going to do? Get up and dance the jig, run out of the room, smile, close the eyes, try to come up with something to say. Show me your face before you were born. You're stuck. Your sense of going anywhere, actually doing anything with that, must and should be logjammed. And if it's logjammed enough, something completely spontaneous, unmediated by thought, free, might show up. Just like that baby that popped out of it, that's popping out now. You're popping out right now. Right out of that canal, boom, free as itself. Doesn't know itself as a boy or a girl. Doesn't know itself as separate. Yes, the neurobiology that the scientists are studying now is clearly looking at that space and saying, this is important developmentally. What they're not quite seeing yet is, this is your original nature. But that doesn't exclude that now this over here starts to have cognition. Your original nature must and will include everything. All inclusive. It just so happens that if this activity of abstracted thinking gets the upper hand, there's a loss of contact with the ground of being. And that's a parallel universe. Apparently. The universe, the truth, the reality, what we are, is prior to that bifurcation, that wandering, that becoming a seeker and looking for home. Isn't that what the spiritual search apparently is? There must be a home that really, really is homey. That really, really is worth going for. See, that's predicated on the notion that it exists. And two, it's predicated on the notion that it can be found. And three, it's predicated on the notion that you can find it. And here's the way. Here's the path. Here's the teachings. Here's the method. Here's the discipline. Reality. The thunder. Did you hear it? It was about two or three rumbles. Yeah. It's not bothering trying to figure out what it's doing. Is it? It doesn't have a self-identity that goes, I think I'll seek another thunder clap to hold hands with or eat together or clap together. It just is. We're trying to figure itself out. And its nature is the nature of this. Appears and disappears. This just seems to last a bit longer. Just to test out the sense of how perception is quite a wobbly thing as well as everything else. Have you noticed how the sense of time, going fast, going slow, moves around every single day? Every single day. Every single 12-hour period, going faster, going slower. Why is that? There's a fundamental reason for that. Very simple. It's the presence or absence of thinking. When there's more thinking in the brain, it seems like time is going slower, or one perceives time. Sometimes it even seems like time is not moving at all. It feels stuck. No thought, or less thought in the brain, more space, less cognition. And maybe you had this during the 45-minute sitting. Did anybody not want to stop sitting? Anybody have that? Do you want to keep sitting? Yeah? A little bit? No? It's okay to vote. Anybody want to stop sitting? Anybody want to really stop sitting? Like, oh, that's great, the bell, I can stop sitting. No? Do you hear me? Okay. When you want to stop sitting, you don't want half what's happening. When you want to keep sitting, the surface of that is you want to keep having what you're having, but more importantly than that, the truth is calling. Truth is like a flame to the moth. And it starts to pull. There's a saying in the East that you meditate like your hair is on fire. That's a bold image. It's hot. Hair's on fire. Even if you're losing it like I am. Faster every day. Wow. Hair on fire? It's an interesting, apt image for what's called Chandra. Chandra is the Buddhist word, Buddhist Pali word for spiritual zeal, zest. It's relaxed, but it's fiery, it's alive. It's what has, like one of my teachers used to teach, I don't know whether he's still teaching now, he used to teach a lot in Israel. And he'd go right in there where it's really, really charged, right in there, close to where Israel and Palestine are just like this. Oh, it's locked. It's really intense. And he'd go right in there. He's a great teacher. Go right in there. He had the contacts, the love, the compassion, the wisdom to be there. To be there as a guest to offer the Dharma. And he said, these students during these retreats, they'd stay up all night. Schedule it in at 9:30, 10 at night, bedtime. He'd come down in the hall, maybe 2 in the morning, 1 in the morning, 3 in the morning. There'd be a whole group of them sitting. Not because they were obsessive, not because they were compulsive. The opposite is because they had Chandra. Their hair was on fire. Turns out, you're not going anywhere. Spiritual path, insight reveals you're not going anywhere. It doesn't matter whether you go to the other side of the planet. You haven't gone anywhere. Even though the body moved 6,000 miles. Why? Because reality, truth, freedom, original nature, it's everywhere. The only thing that says it isn't is distorted, inaccurate perception. And distorted, inaccurate perception arises and passes through the brain cells and bodily chemistry multiple times a day. And it takes a fortunate and sensitive human being to see this. Some human beings, I talked to one the other day actually who has this affliction, describe their life as, I don't want anything to change. I don't like change. I don't do well with change. I don't like things to change. I like things to just stay the same. That is fundamentally going against reality, going against the way things are. It turns out as a subsidiary or a byproduct of this not wanting things to change, this human being that I'm describing has obsessive-compulsive disorder. It's a byproduct of a fundamental, psychiatry wouldn't say this, but I can. It's a fundamental distortion at the ground, contact with reality. So I have a number of reasons, who knows what they are, probably a multiplicity of causes and reasons. There's been a fragmentation there, and now we have this proliferation out into a manifested state that's pretty, it's pretty difficult. Ruminating thoughts, looping, you know what looping is? Looping, I use the word looping, what I mean is the mind just goes like this. You're no good. You're no good. You're no good. You're no good. Wash your hands. 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 It's agony. It's terrible. It's stuck. Talk about samsara on a gerbil wheel. If you've ever had some anxiety that doesn't really let go easily, then you know a little bit about what I'm saying. Thanks for coming. Bye. If you've ever felt obsessively compulsive, then you know even more about what I'm saying. She's going to need more than just a readiness to meditate at some point. She can't function without medications that keep this somewhat in check. You can't keep going like that. You'd kind of just probably go insane if you had looping over and over and over, ruminations of that kind, over and 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 over. Blow up or something. This is an extreme. It's a psychological disorder, so to speak. I'd call it an arrangement, different arrangement rather than a disorder. Challenging. Reality is all-inclusive. There's nothing inside or outside of reality. There's no center to reality, and there's no circumference. We can sense this a little bit when we sense the open space of timelessness, or if we sit or we're just not engaged in any narrative activity too much, maybe. Thoughts can still be there, they don't have to be gone. And just feel the spaciousness of being. Notice that this is not concerned with time. It's not concerned with what's going to happen. It's not concerned with what did happen. It's not even concerned with what is happening. It's not concerned. Aliveness. Presence, if you'd like to call it that. Naturally, abiding in and as and through this. This is that recognizing, see, that recognizing factor. This is where insight comes from. This is where wisdom comes from. This recognizing capacity of awareness, intelligence. To see what's happening, what's going on. Really see it. As this scene deepens, the subject-object dichotomy loses some of its ground, loses some of its proliferating, continuous, habitual tendency. Me, you, me, you, me, you. Here, there. Good, bad, front, back, up, down, yin, yang, old, young. All those dualistic frames of reference come from one central one, and that's the subject-object dichotomy. That was the first. The others come out of that. These things calm down. And so it's just a bump. Just the butt sitting on the seat. Happy. I mean, I'm not saying the butt is happy. I'm saying there's happiness about just sitting on the butt. Or breathing. Simple. People in retreat, because it's often bananas, we'll fall in love with bananas. All of a sudden, it's the most beautiful thing in the world. You usually have to be ready for this experience. Because otherwise, it's just a banana. It's like part of my lunch, or I don't really eat bananas. I'm not really into them. I drink coconut water instead because it has more potassium than bananas. Because they think you're going somewhere. You see, at a certain point in everybody's life of being here, really being here instead of somewhere else, and that's called the story. It's the only other place you can live. You either live in concepts or you live in relative sense of the truth, reality. That's it. And then you have thoughts about the truth, reality, freedom, what you think you are or have known yourself to be. It's all still a story, and it's up here. This isn't thinking. It never thinks. This thinks about this. So you can see this spatially, okay? Here's where the thoughts happen. If you look at it closer, you'll actually see, like some people go, oh, I can see the thought in parts of the brain. It's not just here. I can see it a little over here. Oh, yeah, it's back. It's not down in the lower brain stem. This thing's not thinking. This is where you go when you go into sound sleep. This goes. Not a coma. Because coma is like now we're getting close and death of the body-mind process as we know it could happen down below coma. Now there's no brain activity. Brain activity doesn't come back, doesn't come back, doesn't come back. Clinical death. Coma. Limbic system. Up into the midbrain, emotional brain, forebrain. Beyond the forebrain, Star Trek. Horns. Lord of the Rings. Fantasy. You can't fantasize your way into reality. And you can't meditate your way into reality. You can just think you're meditating your way into reality because you already are reality. This is why the teachings point over and over it. You already are what you're seeking. You already are free. You just don't see this. And so therein lies the potential for the meditation, the inquiry, the so-called work, which I would prefer to call play. Because if we don't get that work is really about play, then in simple terms, we're working too hard. And we have obscured, we have bifurcated, that means separated, we bifurcated work and play. And then along comes a story for each. And how many people prefer work over play? I can't wait to get back to work. You know what's happened there? Play, freedom to be, to do whatever you want, has suddenly become either too much or you're bored with it. And some people who have a lot of material acquisition, they actually have this affliction. They don't know what to do with themselves. They're bored. They could do a lot. They could go here, they could go there, travel around. They're bored. They're bored when they get to the better place, so to speak, in the San Juan Islands of the Puget Sound next to Seattle, looking at the sunset on a lovely sailboat. Just a spa. One time upon a time, I was standing on Mount Haleakala on the Hawaiian island chains on Maui. It's a beautiful mountain. It used to be a volcano. If you go up to the top, you can look down in where the lava once came out. You look down in there, and the mist is just like going like this up there. It's so alive and vital. You can look down from the top of Mount Haleakala, and you look straight down to the ocean. It's like you're in an airplane, but you're not. You look straight down the ocean, like right through the clouds. Boom. Gorgeous. I was just sitting up there going, what a spot. And this Japanese guy was up there, and he's chanting, and he's jumping all around. And I went over to just check it out. And I didn't get too close because he was busy doing some rituals, and he was like, hey, I was very animated, very exciting, very, 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 very passionate. And then he looked at me with this gigantic smile on his face. And I smiled back. Not as broad, as big as his. He's like, I don't know what you're doing, but it looks much pretty good. I didn't mean to tell you that part. The part about Mount Haleakala was I'm halfway up, which is about 3,500 square, 27, I believe it is, feet up above sea level. And at my friend's house, it's 10 in the morning, I'm standing in he's doing, I don't know where he is, he's somewhere else, there's ants all over, he's got these tiny sugar ants all over the house, he doesn't seem to care. Seems out of control to me. You know the sugar ants? We're talking billions of them. That they're everywhere. And he's just living with them. And this is a nice house. This isn't like a shack. So, all of a sudden, what James Joyce, great American writer, called aesthetic arrest appeared. Aesthetic arrest is when the senses just go... Brain, body, mind, senses go. This is what true art is supposed to produce in the observer. Aesthetic arrest. James Joyce called anything else is called pornography, where it draws you into an attraction of relationship with the object that you're looking at, or you don't like it. That's good art because there's a story up here. Or it's not so good, it's not as good as Monet, I like Monet better. It's not aesthetic arrest. So aesthetic arrest appears, I don't know, I'm going to guess, 30 seconds, and the brain goes, yeah, I can see why people move to Hawaii. Commentary. Didn't like affect the state, you see, because everything that appears disappears. Freedom is not a state. Freedom doesn't appear or disappear. It's not a state of consciousness, it's not a feeling. It's what all of these things are happening in. So this is like kind of fun. And memorable. And transitory. Aesthetic arrest on the edge of Mount Haleakala, looking down on the, talk about blue, green, perfect, ambient moment. And then I'm in George Bush Airport in, I believe, Dallas, I think it's Dallas, Texas. George W. Bush International. And my plane is very late. And it's extremely busy. In fact, there's a lot of planes that aren't getting out of there on time. Are we staying overnight? What's going on? You know the moments. Some people are going nuts. They're running around trying to fix this and looking for their sleeping spot. It wasn't that late yet. I was blessed with, I don't care at all. Just don't care. I don't care. I don't care about anything right now. And then Mount Haleakala appeared in George W. Bush International Airport. Same quality. Aesthetic arrest, standing there with all these people going like this. And so we think this stuff is about a place on the earth? Delusion. Gotta go to India. Got to meditate for 17,000 years in the right way. Better eat tofu. Cook the right way. I mentioned last week my neurotic friends in the richest county in America, I think, still, Marin County, California. He said, you can't cook your egg like that. And I said, why not? He said, you have to cook your egg just like this. And I said, you can cook your egg just like that. I'm going to cook mine just like this. Then his wife came in and said, you still cooking your eggs like that? To the husband. Because she's like a vegetarian and all that stuff, and he's like into the ketosis diet where you eat a lot of fat and you go into this state that's like you ran a marathon and you see if you can sustain it. It's a little bit of an aberration, I think, of a healthy diet. But at any rate, some people are doing it. You know, Inuits, Gabe and I talked about this, Inuits did it, and there was a complication there if they kept eating that. Because if you eat blubber all the time and you're not eating any carbs and you don't get any kale, some things are going to get out of balance after a while. But if you're into states of consciousness, yeah, you got to get to Hawaii and avoid George W. Bush Airport. And until you realize it's not about states of consciousness. This isn't about having better experiences and keeping bad experiences away. Reality doesn't give a hoot what you want. It doesn't give a hoot what you want. And it doesn't give a hoot what you don't want. It doesn't give a hoot how willful you are. How committed you are to having things your way, it doesn't give a flying hoot. It says, I'm roaring, and you can either line up with me or you can do some other kind of dance. It's up to you. And the so-called line, which doesn't exist, it's an appearance between being awake and not being awake. And I'm not talking about being conscious or being unconscious. I'm talking about realizing what you are is reality. Or thinking you're something else. That line is so fine, it doesn't even exist. Except as a singular thought that says, I think there's a line there. Yeah? What happened? What was happening before the mind said there's a line there? And what happened after the mind finished saying there's a line there? Like right now. There's a line between you and me. I can't find it, but it's out here somewhere. There's a line. Yeah? What's here before that line as the thought appears? And what's here when that thought's done? And the answer is very simple, and it's two words. Just this. Or if you prefer the koan version of that, you say to somebody, what is this? What is this? Now watch your brain. What is this? A room? Done. A building? Done. Sitting together? Done. What is this? 8:28. There's going to be a limited number of things that the brain throws, and then there's nothing to say. And for some people, they don't even have those things because they already go right past all that stuff that they might think this is. And open to what this is. Open to what this is, you open to what you are. So this could sound, yes, it could. I'm thinking of it. This could sound like thoughts or a problem. Like the doctor, good doctor said to me on Saturday, if we just stopped thinking, if we never thought, we'd be better off. Well, what I didn't say to him is too late. You started thinking and I started thinking. Okay, it's too late. The cat's out of the bag. The race has started. The clock is ticking. See, this is a bifurcated view that says thoughts. They're not part of right view. Well, if they're not part of right view, how come right next to right view in the Eightfold Path of the Buddha, brilliant, elegant, comprehensive teaching about the nature of how to live, right beside right view is right thinking. Wow. Turns out right thinking is so simple. Generous, forgiving, compassionate, loving, kind thoughts. Imagine having those kind of thoughts all the time. We get spots of that. And then we have the other kinds of thoughts. Comparative, judgmental, blaming, criticizing. Thoughts colored by the emotions of the moment, fearful thoughts, sad thoughts, thoughts of boredom, disinterest, uncertainty, etc., etc. It just goes round and round and round and round. That's samsara. That's the curriculum. And it's the opportunity. So I would say that easing off of the gas pedal of your craving, seeking, trying to go someplace life is critical. If you don't find the pause button, then samsara just rolls. And so sitting down, historically, stopping, if possible, within that pause, seems to be a time-honored and effective way to get a bit of a reorientation. I really had a sense in George Bush International that I was completely and utterly all alone. And it absolutely didn't matter. It was wonderful. I looked around from that state, Mount Haleakala state, and it seemed to me that everybody else was clearly not having Mount Haleakala. Now, this is just a perception, because if you think you're somewhere that other people aren't, you're lost. You're lost. I'm not saying they're not lost too, but you're definitely lost. If you think you're in a better place, a higher place, a loftier place, a more noble place, you're lost. If you think you're better off because you have physical health, mental health, or material wealth, you're lost. I'm not saying they, who you're comparing yourself to, aren't lost too. Why was it uttered some hundreds of years, I believe, if I've got the history right, and don't quote me on this, after the Buddha lived, taught, and passed on, that this nirvana, this liberation, this freedom from the disease, the afflictive disease of samsara, the limitation of samsara, how come hundreds of years, apparently after the Buddha had come and gone, did somebody utter, they did, proclaim, samsara is nirvana. Perpetual wandering is liberation? Perpetual wandering is extinction of suffering? Talk about koan. How does this work? It doesn't work. In a brain that has organized itself, a brain and a body that has become myelinated, if I use the neurological term, for how this thing influences this thing, it doesn't make any sense if that brain is believing that samsara is something to remove, to get away from, to transcend. It doesn't make any sense to a brain that goes, nirvana is somewhere other. At the end of the path of samsara, nirvana appears. Doesn't make any sense. So let's go straight to it. Samsara is nirvana. What could that mean? There's only one response. When it's recognized that there's no one owning anything, doesn't matter how many titles for objects your name is on, you don't own anything, not even this body mind. And even more profound and interesting, perhaps, you're not in here. You're not in here in the way you think you are, because the thought says, I am, and then fills in the sentence. And it comes and it goes. That does not substantiate an I or me, to which the story of I or me or mine is attached. And as that is clarified, then the whole notion of the path to another place, the whole notion of the subject-object dichotomy, the whole notion of the me that's going to evolve to a better, higher, better nirvana, all comes into question. And when it comes into question profoundly and deeply, directly enough, then it's clear there's no one who ever suffers, and there's no one who gets free. Now we're getting closer to what the statement's pointing at. Samsara is nirvana. But only for those with little dust in their eyes who realize there isn't anyone suffering. There just appears to be someone who thinks they're suffering. And there isn't anyone who gets free or gets liberated. It just appears that there's one who thinks they're getting freer or getting liberated. It's all mist. Disappearing acts, if you will. In a play of miraculous, beautiful reality unfolding. So then there's this thing called glimpses. When we are, you might say, ripe, as some people would say, not distracted, available for some degree of a samadhi of sorts, like stillness, we seem to be more open. A glimpse shows up, and what these words are pointing at makes total sense. And then, like the aperture of the camera that opened, it closed back down. The I concept, as we discussed last couple of weeks in particular, is very, very subtle. It is the first concept, and because it's the first concept, in many cases, watch, it is the last concept. I am going to die, are you? What if you, in the you form or I form that says I am going to die, was never born? Body-mind was born. Body-mind was born, and the body-mind will die. Notice the I concept that attaches itself to this and says, I am going to die. Really? How do you know? When the Buddha pointed at the unborn, it's another word for the unconditioned, immaculate nibbana, unconditioned true nature, non-dual awareness, he pointed at what he called the unborn, the unconditioned. It isn't a thing. It can't be objectified. It's not an experience. When the senses go into, as Joyce pointed out, aesthetic arrest, something clearly different is going on there. There's no seeking, no grasping, no resistance. But then that comes and goes. That can't be the eternal. That comes and goes in and through what? Like this room, this building, this earth, this universe, as you describe it, you know, the solar system, let's say, is your universe. What do you put the boundary on? What is that occurring in? No word. Notice that. That is abiding. And that is completely and utterly unconditioned. So we make this dualistic split between the unconditioned, spacious, unbounded nature and the conditioned. That which comes and goes, and that within which that which comes and goes abides. Notice the subtlety of that dualistic view. That's a thought that says there's two there. Just like there's a thought that says there's two here. It's important to if you have the interest, which you don't have to, but if you have the interest, it's important to get this so that it can truly resonate. Because if you don't get this, see this, and this starts to malfunction, dementia sets in, for example. By the way, we all have some dementia. We're just undiagnosed. I'm stretching the curve. This starts to be more difficult. You know, it's hurting more. Doesn't work as well. I'm not saying that it isn't still quite possible for these things to profoundly clarify. But it becomes more difficult. That's why if you take a young child, quite a young child, who's just beginning to have cognitions, which they do in Tibet, what's left of it, you give them pointing out instructions. They point directly at these things I'm talking about and give them direct, experiential, energetic transmission. Not the words, the energy of the truth. They pick it up right away because they're so close to it already. They haven't hardly left it. It makes complete sense, intuitively. We get desensitized as we go through our years. We get desensitized. We become habituated. when we become cyclical, traumatized, let's not forget that one. The next thing you know, it's like, wow, these words kind of nice, I guess. I don't live near this. I live in this clouded head. And this body that hurts. And this slowly but gradually increasing fatigue. That exercising and dieting, sleeping seems to have no true effect upon. Temporary relief through the nap or getting fully distracted into some activity. Inserted right there into that. Wisdom teachings say, sitting, walking, standing, eating if possible, mindfully, not only makes complete and utter common sense, but it's your only true insurance plan. That movie that I once saw, you might have seen it too, with George Clooney, it was called Gravity. And him and this other astronaut, a woman, are up in a spaceship and they lose control. If you've seen the movie, you'll know what I'm talking about. But anyways, they kind of lose control and they're going to like live. And so it's very edgy and like a good movie. You know, they try to make it really kind of as real as possible. It's kind of captivating. And he ends up just flying off into space. And from what you can sense at that point in the movie, like he's dead, he's gone. And she is working on surviving. Then she has this dream while she's working on surviving. She's in a spaceship still. She has this dream that he comes back. And he's alive. And he makes it back. You know, gets back in the spaceship with her. And then she wakes up from the dream. And she sees that it's a dream. Waking up means seeing that this is a dream. Now, the way the movie depicted it, it was very sort of black and white. Because that's how we experience waking up from the dream state at night. It's very black and white. Our mind immediately goes, that was a dream. This is whatever you call it. Many people say this is reality now. They make that contrast. What I'm saying is, this is a waking dream. And the definition of a dream is that it comes and goes, just like the night dream comes and goes. This dream is coming and going. When you see clearly, more and more clearly, that everything that's happening here is appearing and disappearing, then you see that nothing lasts. And once you see that nothing lasts, then you see that that is exactly the same as everything keeps changing. And then you see that nothing and everything are the same. And that's not a person seeing that. That's not Paul seeing that. That's awareness waking up to itself. It's the same thing the Buddha said when they said, what is the true nature of the mind? And he said, the true nature of the mind is the inseparability of awareness and emptiness. And when he used the word emptiness, he was pointing at everything that appears to be of form. Because everything that appears to be of form is empty of permanence, solidity, and possessibility. So it turns out that if you find out what the body does well on food-wise, regardless of what the books say or what somebody else says, it makes sense to eat that. And if you figured out that you can go well on 7.5 hours of sleep a night, and the book says you should be getting 8, or you can do well on 6, you'd probably go with that. If you find out you can't do well on 8, you need 9, you probably want to go with that. You want to find out what works for the system. That takes a while, doesn't it? It takes a while to see. And it changes even when you find out something works for a while. Then it changes. So it keeps you really humble and it keeps you really up to date if you're really paying attention to the curriculum that's being given here. And what I mean by that is the curriculum of truth. You're in the school of truth. They told you you were in Gainesville, but you're really not. You're in the school of truth. It just so happens that there's another label for this place. It's called Gainesville. But the school of truth is happening everywhere, but only for those with little dust in their eyes. Others think there's something else happening, like a political election. Again. It's a story. Interesting. Some people's livelihoods are tied up in that. Doing the story, writing the story, narrating the story. So you just get to see the story as like a mirror. It's a reflection that points straight back into that which sees the story. When you see that, then you start to see that everything that's happening is a mirror. Everything that's happening, people's eyes, the sun, the moon, the thunder, anything that's happening, everything that's happening is a reflection. So awareness can see itself not as an object distinct from the world of experience, but inseparably unified, non-dual with that which it sees. That's what the Buddha said when he said the true nature of the mind is the inseparability of awareness and emptiness. He could have said the true nature of the mind is the inseparability of awareness and everything, or nothing. He just happened to say emptiness. Which is fullness, by the way. The more this is not interfered with and allowed to open into its true nature, it becomes empty, empty of misunderstanding. Empty of distorted perception. And when it becomes empty of misunderstanding and empty of distorted perception, it becomes full of what? Truth. So, I'm commenting on myself here. I'm saying, this language is going back and forth between a very definitive dualistic frame of reference and then language that cuts through that, like, show me your face before you were born. That's not a dualistic inquiry or question. And there's a very specific intention behind that. If someone, in this case me, was sitting here and simply speaking directly, continually for 1 hour and a half, or whatever time, from the non-dual perspective, all of us would either relax fully into that or we'd get annoyed and want to leave. This isn't making any sense. This is, I don't get it. I don't understand it. It's like we have to just gently coax the intellect to come into the heart, to rest out of its obsessive thinking tendency. That's all it is. To cease and desist. Cease and desist. What's the word? Mm-hmm. Yeah? From going round and round and round and round and round. Which is what happens every night in deep sleep. It ceases and desists from seeking, looking, working on any problems. So we're just waking up. If there's any waking up that's going on, we're just waking up to what's always already here. And know for sure that that is assured and precisely correct and fundamentally reliable, especially when you go, this is completely familiar. even as one might say, this is so fresh, this is so new, this is so alive and completely familiar simultaneously. Why? Because realization is the absolute same as remembrance. It's not remembering in the sense of remembering the fence in my backyard. No. It's non-cognitive, non-language-based remembering. And it's available all the time. Just look in people's eyes if they'll let you and don't get lost in the story. And if there's not a story coming back and there's not a story coming out, what's meeting what? And the answer is very clear. Original true mind is meeting original true mind. It's not miles away and you don't have to meditate for 70 years or have 16 lifetimes to warm up. It's play. It's the Layla. It's the play of consciousness. It's the Buddha field. It's home. It's here. This is not a belief system. Because some people go, well, okay, I just need to kind of get with it and sort of believe it. And stay with that. You can't stay with anything. Nothing stays with you. And as soon as you pause a little and you check out, what is the sense of you? What really is this sense? Because the thought does create a sense, okay? There's a bodily sense of you. And it ain't generally outside the frame very far. Which is like, let's say you like to relax, which I'm not really into much at that these days, but I used to practice a lot of relaxation. You know, intentional relaxation, like lie down, corpse pose and all this stuff. But it might come back, I don't know, right now it's not happening. But in the relaxation, then I would look around for the me that was relaxing. Could never find it. But the sense of me that sometimes gets going around, like let's say you have a strong opinion in the brain, and you really believe, like some opinion pops up over here, and you go, oh, and then an opinion pops up over here. That's like a contraction, right? So two contracted opinions are like now on stage, right? It goes, and the I, me sense is very identified. This is the truth here. That's why I have an opinion about it. You know, and it often needs a contrast to get mobilized. You know, it doesn't bother mobilizing itself in relation to the blue sky, have you noticed? It doesn't go, I have a real strong opinion about it. It's like another human being is representing something that seems very contrary or wrong, unjust, stupid, ignorant, unfair, blind. Now it's an opinion. Right, wrong. Comes and goes. That body sense is there. Where's that body sense of me? Is it in here? Is it in here? Is it in here? Where is it? Is it in here? Oh, it's very interesting. Because that thought generally creates that body sense of identification. These are my fingers. My leg. Goes out into the object. My water bottle. My house. My car. My friend. Mine. Just proliferates out. That's the dream. That's the dream. No more, no less a dream than the dream that's going to come in the sleep tonight if one comes. Watch it come and go. Watch the bodily sense of identification. This is me. Come and go. And then begin to have a peek, because it's right there. Have a peek at that which is seeing the body sense come and go. You can't localize that which is seen, but the seeing is happening. When I use the word seeing, I mean awareness. I don't mean visual sight with the eyes. Is that clear? It's not visual sight with the eyes. It's like if you wanted to use a chakra model idea of this, it's like the third eye. I don't really like that because it starts... What about the fourth eye? And then you got a chocolate on top of this chocolate that's even better. It's like a thousand petal lotus instead of just a blue pearl. It sounds better. It's tricky stuff because it starts to suggest better is up. That's not fair to down. Okay, that's dualistic again. It's like, is left better than right? You know, the right-handed people better than the lefties? No. You righty? I'm a lefty. See? You know, the women better than the men? The older people worse than the... You people on it, you're not listening. Gotta start the whole talk over. Time's up. We're gonna pull out the test. You didn't get anything. Oh, wait, you got what you got. You're supposed to get nothing. Great. Okay, you win. Let me stop.